doesn't matter your age. And when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, we're living now and we're all in this place. So be sure to smile at each passing face as it draws near. So tarry here.
Good afternoon. This is Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford, and
I'm Stasi Okalski.
And we are here as your co-hosts. That was Andy Offutt Irwin singing his own creation, Tarry Here. And we like to open this show with music. Doesn't happen every time, but Andy's given us permission to use his song. But we missed a week, and I hope you noticed, listeners. Maybe you went to a podcast instead when you couldn't find us on air at noon last week. We had technical difficulties, and it just wasn't going to happen. But if you do want to hear podcasts of earlier shows, you can go to talltales.enlightenradio.org and you'll find whole lists of them. Today's stories on air and on our podcast, once it gets up, is about summer vacations. And I'm going to start off with a family story. But before we do that, Stash, do you have any lead-in you want to do? You could talk about last night's performance with Adam.
I would point out that last night we were able to witness a wonderful performance at Shepherd University. Shepherdstown's own Adam Booth performed for a little over an hour for a group at the Irma Bird Hall.
Irma Aura Bird Hall.
Yes.
Isn't that a great name?
Right. And Adam did a wonderful job. He gave examples of different kinds of stories that you would hear from an Appalachian storyteller.
Sang a ballad.
And sang a ballad, which was wonderful. No musical accompaniment. And very much Appalachian.
Yeah.
And told a great jump tale, and also told a jack tale, and had his own twist on the ending, which was really phenomenal.
That jump tale had at least three jumps, because yes. I jumped twice, and I saw you and Terry jump once when
absolutely.
I didn't.
So it was a lot of fun, and people who listen to this station, to our broadcast, should try to keep track of what's going on at Shepherd University. There's lots of storytelling in the area.
Yeah, that was part of
Hagerstown also.
That was part of the Appalachian Studies Center. There were teachers there. They're still here in
right.
town.
They were having a workshop today.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So this week's topic is summer vacations. And Fanny's going to start us off.
You really want me to dig into this right now.
Yes, okay. I do. The airwaves are all yours.
Well, I already confessed that this is another one of my long stories. So we're going to do it in two parts with a station break in the middle. Right. So this is a story from my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes, who was an African-American and son of an escaped slave. T.H. Barnes, for Thomas Henry, as the family calls him, lived for almost 5 years of his childhood at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, a well-endowed school and residence for 300 free-born African-American children, founded in 1836 by three Quaker women from one extended family, Anna Shotwell, Hannah Shotwell Murray, and Mary Murray. In 1864, this institution received several scholarships from Oberlin College in Ohio, and T.H. Barnes was selected at age 14 to receive one of the scholarships to enter Oberlin College, but he fell ill during an epidemic of typhoid fever at the school. The school's physician and the skilled nurses there cared for him, and though 12 other children died that winter in the institution, T.H. survived. After 3 months recuperating in the school infirmary, he was pronounced well enough to rejoin the other children. So this is the story of his summer following that illness, and this is in his words.
Well, Miss Annie Shotwell, founder and now a member of the governing board of the New York Colored Orphan Asylum, was determined that I should be the recipient of an Oberlin scholarship the following fall. I'd studied hard to win the Oberlin scholarship, but at the expense of my health. Miss Annie concluded to take me, still weak and emaciated, to spend the summer at her country home in the village of West Farms in Westchester County, New York. So the 1st of June, 1864, with an extra suit of clothes and the envy of all the boys, I entered the lady's carriage with her for the 10-mile drive to her farm. We started early that beautiful summer morning, lunch basket on the seat between us, and made several stops to call on Miss Annie's friends en route. Late in the afternoon, we arrived at her home, Murray Manor, an antiquated colonial farmhouse, two stories high, with huge pillars, dormer windows, and slanting roof. We were met on the steps by a young, smiling, colored housekeeper, freeborn Nancy. Miss Annie was a maiden lady, advanced in years, short in stature, not more than 100 pounds. She was of the positive Quaker type, of rare and exceptional mental ability, wealthy, and noted for philanthropy and support of many national and local movements for the betterment of humanity, from Negro and women's suffrage to temperance and uplift and education of the poor. Well, that first evening, Nancy, Miss Annie's housekeeper, quickly prepared a light supper of cold boiled ham, bread and butter, cheese, currant preserves from the farm, and hot tea. There were two small tables set, one in the center of the dining room for Miss Annie, with fine white damask linen, rare delicate china, and heavy antique silver. Everything simple, but neat and well appointed. Miss Annie took her seat at the table with simple grace, dressed in her immaculate Quaker costume, pausing for a moment in silent prayer. You would not have dreamed she had ridden 10 dusty miles before dinner. Nancy poured the tea and stood at attention near the table. Miss Annie ate slowly but with appetite. Finishing her meal, she directed Nancy to remove the serving dishes to Tommy's table, my table, which was nicely set, but not so richly. Now, I was supposed to be out exploring the barn and garden, but I had been quietly peeking in the window, closely observing every detail. When called, I came in. Oh, how innocent. Miss Annie greeted me, directing me to the table in the corner, her hand on my shoulder, saying, Thomas, you cannot be very hungry after that basket of food you ate in the carriage. Miss Shotwell had not the slightest idea of a 14-year-old boy's capacity. I did not spend much time in silent prayer or formality. When I had finished, Nancy had nothing left to put in the refrigerator. I should tell you all that Miss Annie did not make me wait or put me at a separate table on account of color prejudice. Her housekeeper, Nancy, as a servant, did not dine with us. Miss Annie may have considered us both her equal before God. I know that I was not her equal, intellectually or socially, not her servant, but her ward, brought to her home for my special benefit, the improvement of my health and mind. I was given tasks, not generally laborious work, but expected to perform promptly and efficiently. Each evening, early to bed, and morning, ready to rise. She gave me books that were beyond my intelligence, but she took pains to explain them to me. There was the daily routine of chores, study, and worship, including Bible reading and prayer, together, all sitting together, morning and night. Miss Anna Shotwell was an ideal Christian, adhering to the tenets of her creed, no can't and no cannot, no affectation, no emotional excitement. When dark came that first night, Nancy showed me my bedroom and my room, up two flights to a great spacious garret over the whole house, 8 feet high in the center, but sloping to 4 feet on the sides, 6 large dormer windows in all, 2 on each side of the house, 1 on each end, the floor bare, except where the bed stood with a carpet strip on each side. The bedstead had huge, old-fashioned round posts, head and foot boards, corded to hold the straw-filled tick mattress, with 2 sheets, a light quilt, and a feather pillow, all scrupulously neat and clean. There was a quaint chair and a small old table with a cloth cover, candlestick, candle, and a matchbox. Round the room were cabinets and clothes presses. On the walls, pegs hanging full of men and women's clothes, greatcoats, heavy cloth, dresses, everything gray and brown. In the corner, several massive oaken chests with great iron locks and hinges, old tables and other antique furniture and fixtures hung and arranged in perfect, painfully achieved order, no dirt, no dust, and no rubbish. Everything carefully arranged, but oh, so grim and quiet. My bed looked like a great white field. As the light faded, I lit the candle, but oh my, it cast great frightening shadows. I blew out the light, and the twilight through those draped windows cast great figures across the floor in that deathly stillness. there I was, alone in that great garret room, afraid to lie down, afraid to stay up. I looked toward the stairway, thinking of flight, but it looked so deep and dark. I dropped to my knees beside the chair and prayed as I never had before. Furtively, I looked to the windows and then all around me. An odd, cold sense of security came over me. I stood looking in every direction into that fearful silence. A few lines from Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven fully illustrates my position and emotions, deep in darkness, wondering, fearing, doubting. Dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the stillness was unbroken. The darkness gave no token. The only word there spoken was the whispered word. Except there was no word spoken, and no echo for me. I may have whispered, "Mother." And then I turned, got into one corner of that gigantic bed, large enough for a dozen my size, and then with all my senses alert, I lay thinking of the past long winter, of the sickness, of how so many of my fellows had died, many beside me in the same room. Now I was well and growing strong. I had no feeling of sleep. I closed my eyes, thank God for my life, for my young brother, my relatives, and my friends who'd been so good to me, and the thought came unbidden. Why should I worry? Fear left me, and I peacefully fell asleep, dreaming that my beloved mother, long deceased, sat at my bedside. That dream is as vivid now as 60 years ago, and I have it, and have it as you may. I believe it was my mother's influence that took fear from me in that great garret. I never was afraid after. Morning came. I woke at 5, the usual time, made my bed with the same precision I found it the night before. Downstairs, I told Nancy my night's experience and made her laugh. When Miss Annie appeared, I told her the tale in detail. She was visibly affected. At prayers, she asked that God assist her to make me happy and content. After breakfast, she showed me over the place, the vegetable and flower gardens, and took me to Mr. Gibson, who ran the farm from his house a short distance up the road, with a wife and sons to help him maintain the good barn and all that appertained, the cows, chickens, and gardens that supplied the farm. I was well pleased with the place, but the quiet and lonesomeness after years of daily association with hundreds of children and adults, the pleasantness of the farm seemed a desert. Oh, I was steadfastly resigned to my situation, Miss Annie all kindness and anxious that I be content. Days passed slowly, but pleasantly, with routine chores, gardening, drawing water from the well, errands to the village, study and reading. Sunday came. Nothing to do on Sabbath but read. In the afternoon, 3 large family coaches came, filled with Quaker men, women, and young people, but they were as quiet as their elders. Sabbath school in the parlor was Bible reading, questions asked and answered, and prayers, but little singing. I was the observed of all observers. Miss Annie seemed proud to present me as one of her asylum boys brought here for physical and mental improvement. They all seemed pleased to hear me read from the Bible and sing. They had a light lunch and started for home, some distance for all. I grieved to see them go, for the house, standing on a side road with few passers-by, was more quiet and lonely than ever. Nancy had gone to New York early. Miss Annie sat in the parlor reading. I went early to bed after a long, lonesome day. The next Sunday, Quaker meeting, Miss Annie said, would be 5 miles distant at Fordham, and I had something to look forward to. I'm going to stop there, Steph.
Yes. Want to take a break here?
Yes, please.
You're listening to enlightenradio.org, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and this is the Storytelling Hour. And we've just been listening to the first part of a story from Fanny Crawford's family about T.H. Barnes when he was a youth.
T.H. Barnes' summer vacation. Not much of a vacation so far.
So far, I'm waiting for the excitement there from a childhood.
It does pick up okay. In the second part.
So are we ready to go?
Sure. Do you want to talk about the Speak series
I can do that. Yes. The Speak series, storytelling series at Shepherd University. This past week, we heard Kevin Locke, a hoop dancer, who told stories and sang and had audience participation, which was wonderful. It was a great performance.
Yeah, he got about 20 people up dancing with him.
Yes, he did. The only disappointment that evening for me was that there were no males that volunteered to get up and dance. And I had this thought that if I were 20 years younger or 40 years younger, I might have raised my hand.
You would have grabbed some hoops and gotten up there on the floor.
Yes, but I was afraid I might make a spectacle of myself lying on the floor gasping. So in August, we have Jane Dorfman at Reynolds Hall. And Jane is going to be telling stories from the Arabian Nights. And this performance is for adults. This is not a performance that you would want to bring young children to. So in September at Reynolds Hall and September 19th, which will be a change as far as the Tuesday. It's normally second Tuesday a month. This will be the third Tuesday a month because of Bill Harley's schedule. Bill Harley is famous American storyteller who entertains, sings, and he is an Grammy Award-winning performer. In October, on October 10th, a special presentation from England by Skype. Jan Blake will be telling stories. In November, again at Reynolds Hall, November 14th, Mark Harshman, a poet laureate of West Virginia, will be here at Shepherdstown. And on December 12th, Shepherdstown's own Adam Booth will close out the series for this year, the fifth year in this series, at Reynolds Hall and do the final performance for the Speak Stories this season.
Thank you, Stosh.
You're welcome, Fanny. So can we hear the second part of your story?
Yes, absolutely. Well, so this is T.H. finishing up the story of his summer vacation. That next Sunday,
was to be at Quaker Meeting 5 miles distant at the meeting house in Fordham. I had earlier told Miss Annie that I could drive a horse and well knew the care of a horse. She showed me a splendid old-fashioned carriage under an expanse of old oilcloth out in the barn, all unused for several years, so very dusty. I knew I could clean it, as it was in good shape. She had faith in me, saying we'd get a horse in the village. I opened wide the inner barn doors and with heroic effort got that old ark out on the barn floor. I was thrilled at the prospect of the drive to Fordham and the chance to show my patron my training with horse and carriage care from the institution. Friday morning, with Nancy's help and a supply of clean cloths, soap, brushes, and oil, I went to work on the old coach. And with this new inspiration came energy. There was every convenience in the barn, including wrenches and levers for removing the wheels. Nancy gave a lift when I needed one, and late in the afternoon I had the old hack looking like new, varnished parts rubbed in oiled cushions and upholstery well cleaned, door handles, lamps, and all the brass parts polished. It was a rare old wagon now, fit for a queen, a coupe for two to ride inside and two on the driver's seat. Nancy fetched out Miss Annie, who seemed positively astonished. Had she not been a Quaker void of demonstrative affection, she would have kissed me. She actually smiled, the picture of suppressed pleasure and delight, saying, "Why, Thomas, thou hast done remarkably. Thou art a genius making that carriage new again." I closed the barn door, washed up, satisfied my very keen appetite with a good supper, and slept till daybreak on Saturday morning. That real work had done me good. Feeling just splendid, I went down to the village to see the man about the horse. He was surprised to see me so small, and said so. I was surprised to see the horse so large, but did not say so. A young white gelding in good condition and good spirit, which pleased me much, but great Scott, how dirty and stained he was. The man pressed me much about my driving ability, and I soon convinced him that I was expert. As he was just leaving with the horse to go to work, he said I could come for the horse at 3 that afternoon. I was back there at 3 sharp and met the man as he drove in, the horse hitched to a small cart, which of course I did not want. But to my surprise and chagrin, he disclosed that the great heavy work cart harness was the only one available. When I reached our farm with horse and harness, Mr. Gibson, the farm manager, laughed loud and long at that harness for the fine carriage. At the barn, we found some odds and ends of tack, and I rigged up a creditable harness and then went to work with soap, water, and blacking. I knew Miss Annie would not tolerate any work Sunday morning, so I asked Nancy to help. We got down to business, gave the animal a good feed with a couple of apples, stroked him, and he soon accepted me as his best friend. Such a scrubbing that horse never had before. His coat had been like scarlet with mud, stain, and dust, but we made it white as snow. Big, strong Nancy caught my enthusiasm and neglected her own Saturday work to assist. I owe my success to her. Before dark, we had accomplished a transformation from dirty cart horse to perfect carriage steed. with trimmed fettered locks and mane, blackened hooves, and all wrapped up in a clean blanket on a good bed of straw. That horse slept that night with dreams as a royal charger. Sunday morning, I was up with the larks, dressed in my Sunday suit, shoes blacked, and went to feed my horse. Standing before him, I was seized by a new horror. Those carriage shafts were entirely too small for that big horse. I did not want to tell Miss Annie my plight, so ran post-haste over the field to Gibson. He saw me approach and came running, thinking from my speed and excitement something serious had happened. When I told him my trouble, he sat and laughed. "I thought of that yesterday, but forgot to speak of it," he said. "We'll go to the next farm. They can help us." So up we went, half a mile or more, where the farmer took us to his wagon house and a large pair of shafts. Good, but this being Sunday and the last minute, of course, they were very dirty. We took them to the well for a good washing and promised to return them Monday. They did not exactly fit Miss Annie's carriage, so we made a good connection on one side of the axle and wired the other side, wrapping both couplings neatly with black cloth. Gibson helped me hitch up, everything complete, and A-plus number one, an hour ahead of time. Making myself ready, I called Nancy for inspection, and with her pronouncement of perfection, I drove to the front door where Miss Annie waited. With true footman etiquette, I helped my lady into her coach, holding the reins in my left hand. That horse pranced, chafing at his bit. The lady noticed and said, "Thomas, canst thou drive that horse with safety?" I reassured her, got up on the box, sitting square in the center of the seat, my feet dangling, for my legs were not long enough to reach the floor. Miss Anna Shotwell, the personification of dignity, sat upright on the inside seat. We were a picture of perfection, save for my detecting a slight expression of doubt on Miss Shotwell's face. That horse, feeling splendid in his good fortune, started off an easy trot. That coach was a plaything for him. Miss Anna called me, "Thomas, thou must not drive fast. This is the Lord's day, and the sun is very warm for the horse." The fact is, I was perfectly confident of driving safely, but I could not prevent the horse's trot. He felt good with a light load and a fine road. We had not gone over a mile when we came up to a great cumbersome coach with two horses jogging along very moderately. My horse turned out to pass, and I could not prevent him. He obeyed every move of the reins in turning out, but I could not check his gait, and past we went. The occupants of that coach were a Quaker family of five. They bowed to Miss Shotwell and she to them. I knew she would think me rude for passing them, and when she saw what was happening, she spoke in a low, animated voice, "Thomas!" Some distance ahead, I saw another similar outfit. The horse brought us nearer and nearer with his easy trot. I heard that voice again. "Thomas!" This time louder than before. Concluding that something must be done, I slid down from my seat. Feet on the floor, I had the advantage, and I drew up sharp on the lines. My horse slacked up, and none too soon, for we were right upon the rig ahead. The horse badly wanted to pass, but now I was master and held him back. He was splendid after that. By this time, there were several vehicles ahead as we drew near the village and the meeting house, people assembling. I would have drawn up in front of the door to let my lady out, but she said to drive under the shed, this side of the church where other coaches stood. A man came, opened the carriage door, and in a very friendly tone said, "Anna, how do you do?" She answered with his first name. I hurried the horse to the manger and came back to her. She took me to one side. I expected a great reprimand, but she spoke very pleasantly. "Thomas, I understand the challenge, but you should never drive by an elder without permission." There were 25 or more well-fitted carriages filled with Quakers, young and old, all knew each other, shaking hands, calling each by first names, no Mr. or Mrs. They entered the meeting house, a low one-story building, windows on all sides like a country schoolhouse, plain, without embellishment. Inside was one large room, bare floors, chairs and benches against the walls, a few in the center. A small table at one end held a pitcher, pail of water, glasses, a Bible, and small books, perhaps hymnals. When all were seated, women on one side, men on the other, there was profound silence for 5 or 10 minutes. Then a woman went to the table and began to speak in a moderate tone, then another, and another, men and women, till many had spoken. A passage of scripture was read and discussed. There did not seem to be any particular leader. When quiet came, quite a number got up and walked about in single file, and then all were seated for a final silence, and then mingled in friendly conversation, the whole event informal or as the spirit moved them. Miss Shotwell seemed pleased to present me as a boy from the orphan home, and all seemed to know of me and greeted me cordially. Goodbyes were said. All departed their several ways. On the road home, I had hard work to keep the horse to a slow trot. He was anxious for speed, really delighted with conditions. About noon, the sun hot, the road dusty, horse and driver sweating, Miss Shotwell sitting erect, cool and dignified, we arrived home safe and sound. Nancy met us at the gate, all expectant to know of the trip, Mr. Gibson too. Miss Anna was as loud in her praise as her dignity would permit. Now Monday morning came with a new duty, as every other Monday was Nancy's wash day. Every other week, the laundry was in the cellar, equipped with every old-fashioned convenience. Equipped with rainwater cistern and wood stove. Nancy offered to do my washing, 4 shirts, stockings, and handkerchiefs, but I insisted on doing the trick myself. The women seemed astonished when the task was complete, washed, dried, and ironed by 1 o'clock. Miss Annie questioned me as I explained. My mother had taught me basic housework, and I'd learned the laundry stunt in the institution. I would advise every boy to acquire the rudiments of domestic science. Care of a house is basic education. Often during a life, he will find it mighty handy and convenient. But the 4th of July was nearing, and I was anxious to return to the orphanage, if only for a day. Miss Annie was not in favor. Knowing I was homesick, she feared I would not return. She finally consented with my promise to return the next day. So the morning of July 3rd, Miss Annie, to my surprise, told me to get ready to go immediately so as to spend the whole 4th of July with my brother. She gave me 75 cents, 20 for railroad fare over and back, and the balance for spending money. I was very happy. After midday dinner took my leave. Gibson told me of a shortcut across the river, so I concluded to walk and save the money. Taking my time, I arrived at the institution at 6 p.m. and received a wonderful welcome from everyone. The children flocked round me, asking a million questions. The teachers congratulated me, pleased to see me so much improved in health. My brother was so happy he cried, for we had never been parted before. I divided my money with him, and that soon dried his tears. Next morning, we were up at daylight for the big day, and with our visiting and fireworks, it went well, but all too quickly. The next day came the trial. I had promised Miss Annie I would return to West Farms. She had been so good to me, I could not disappoint her. So I bade all goodbye, and with permission from the superintendent, my brother and several other boys walked a mile or more with me. I had quite a bundle to carry, for I was taking back books and other things I needed. I could not walk fast, so it was quite dark when I reached West Farms. The old lady was delighted to see me. She'd become attached to me and feared I would not return. She sat down beside me, asking many questions to learn how I felt. I did love her, but my visit had spoiled me, and I grew more homesick each day. On the quiet, I rode home to Aunt Caroline in Brooklyn, asking her to come and see me. She came as soon as she received the letter and at once understood my plight. She and Miss Annie had a long talk and agreed it would be better for me to leave, as they feared for my health. In a few days, I received a letter containing a dollar bill with instructions to come to Uncle Peter and Aunt Caroline in Brooklyn, and a letter from Miss Annie. She read that letter, gave me a good long talk, prayed for me, gave me a dollar and a nice old-fashioned knife. Nancy was sorry to have me go, gave me 25 cents and the address of her people in New York, extracting a promise to come to see her there. Kissing me, she bid me goodbye and then turned quickly away. Miss Annie arranged for Gibson to drive me to the institution. She gave me a letter for the superintendent. Before I got into the wagon, she held my hand long, advising, directing, and admonishing me. And thus I left Miss Anna Shotwell. A sainted woman she was. Why is it that there are not more like her? To those who have the means, the opportunity is so great to make the less fortunate comfortable. I've never met her again, but I cherish her memory and proclaim her praise. On the road that day, Gibson was quite talkative. One sentence I will always remember. "Tommy, you ought to have remained with Miss Shotwell." My life has been long and full, bounding with successes, interesting experiences, and people. And yet I do sometimes wonder what might have transpired differently if I had followed that advice and seen that summer as my preparation for college rather than just a summer vacation.
You're listening to EnlightenRadio.org, broadcasting from Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And I take this moment to just mention that in Hagerstown, Maryland, there is a program called Stories in the Round, and it is organized and run by Fanny Crawford.
Woohoo! Stories in the Round.
Yes, and on July 24th, that's a week from today, Eileen Evans will be there performing at 7 in the evening at the Universal
Unitarian Universal.
Unitarian Universal Church on Searfoss Pike.
And Eileen Evans is a West Virginia teller, so I hope some of our listeners will come out. Hear her.
And in August, Megan Hicks will be there. And she'll be celebrating a very special day with her storytelling, August 28th. Just happens to be someone's birthday. Okay.
That's my brother's birthday too, Stosh.
Yes, how about that?
All right.
So maybe we're related.
Thank you for sharing that. You never know.
Yeah, that's true.
Switched at birth.
Right.
Are you going to tell us a story?
I think you left me time for a story from my childhood.
All right.
I don't have near the
verbiage.
No. I was going to say near the kind of childhood that T.H. did. My family never took a summer vacation. Actually, the first thing I did as far as going away for the summer and camping and things like that happened just before my 18th birthday when I joined the Army. Mm. It was not exactly a vacation. But I'm going to tell you a story about a summer vacation on Dorham Street. Dorham Street was an alley wide enough for one car or a reasonable sized truck to go through. On each side of that alley, there were homes facing the alley itself. We played a thing called handball there. It wasn't like the handball in a court. We had teams. The ball was bounced once before the home plate, and you hit the ball with your fist. And some of the boys hit it with their open palm. And the idea was to hit it just like a baseball, try to hit as far as you could or as hard as you could. We had a base path running up the alley, and there would be a step as first base, and then a manhole cover in the middle of the alley as second base. On the other side, coming back towards home plate, there was a step, which was third base. And then home plate was a manhole cover. And we played that game for hours. One side of that field, in there, so-called field, was very pleasant because Tommy Drust's family lived there. And his mom was real nice, and so was his uncle. On the other side, it was not so pleasant. There was an elderly German man who, believe it or not, had pictures of Nazi soldiers on his bar walls and who had all kind of Nazi symbols inside of his bar. It was his step that was third base, and he hated it when we played there. But we tried to get games early in the morning or in the evening when he was really busy at the bar. One of the things we discovered in playing those games was the youngest boy that ever got involved with us. We considered ourselves the Dorham Street Gang. We weren't really a gang. No jackets, no hand signals and all that. But there were quite a few males in that one square block divided by Dorham Street. Actually, there were only three females under the age of 20. And there were somewhere near 40 males between the age of 1 and 20 in a square, one city block. So we had lots of entertaining to do. One of the games that we played at night was called Red Line. And in playing that handball game, we had discovered a kid by the name of Felipe Martinez, who was only 10 years old and had great hands and was really good at picking up ground balls, catching fly balls. And he became the youngest guy that ever played games with us. Well, Felipe fits into this story in another way. Red Line was played kind of like a prison game. There was a box drawn in chalk on a sidewalk, and there were two teams, sometimes five guys on each team, sometimes six or seven. And the purpose was one team were like the police, the other team were the criminals. So the criminals were out doing their mischief. We had to stay within one block of the box. We were not allowed to go into our own homes, and we could not cross any major street. Anything else was open. On this particular game, there were five of us on the team. Four of my teammates had been caught. I was the only prisoner free. And the other group were guarding that box. The way you set the prisoners free was to be able to step into the box. If you were free yourself, you stepped into the box, all the other prisoners were free to run. And they had to count to 15 before they could start chasing you. Prison break. Well, I watched for a long time from a distance to see how I could get into that box. And then I got what I considered a bright idea. I went to my house, not in the house, but through the alley into my backyard. This is in Baltimore City. There were no grass yards, all cement. At the end of my short cement yard, there was a wooden fence. I climbed over that fence, and I was in Miss Rose's yard. Miss Rose's yard went the opposite way of ours, like a T. To the right in her yard, I went to the end, and there was another fence. That fence was the backyard fence of the Martinez family. And on this particular night, the Red Line box was drawn on the sidewalk next to the Martinez family's front door. I went to the back door of the house. I looked through the window of the door, and I could see Mr. Martinez reading his evening paper and having what I assume was a beer, because it was kind of a amber-colored liquid in a glass. I waited and waited and waited, and then when he leaned over to the right away from the doorway, I opened his back door, went dashing through the kitchen, straight down the hall to the front door, opened it, opened the screen door, stepped off of the front steps, and jumped into the box, setting my team free. We all left. The only time, I think, in my young life when I was considered a hero because I was so brave. The next day, when my father came home from work, and we were finished eating supper, I just asked permission to go out, and someone knocked on the door. It was Mr. Martinez, and he asked if he could speak to my father. And my dad came to the store, said, "Sure, come in." And Mr. Martinez said, "I'd like your son to be with us when I speak to you." Mr. Martinez explained what had happened. My father's jaw dropped. And my dad never hit me in my whole life, not once. And he and Mr. Martinez discussed this while I sat there. And they decided that they didn't even want to know why I had done it, just that I would never do it again. Mr. Martinez and my father shook hands. Mr. Martinez left. And my father, when I started to try to explain, said, "I don't want to know. I really don't want to know. Don't do it again. And you're not going out tonight." that's the end of my summer vacation story.
So well told. Oh, so many memories that brings back of playing on cement.
Oh, my goodness. And believe it or not, sliding into home plate.
Oh, my.
I did that at least twice. And I know other guys in whatever I was wearing, once in shorts, and I got a terrible, they called them a strawberry then, but it looked like someone had taken a very rough grate or something across my leg.
A potato peeler down the side of your leg.
The only thing my mother was glad about when I did that in shorts was that I didn't ruin a good pair of long pants.
Your leg will grow back.
That's right. But my summer vacations were always great as a kid because I got to play in the streets a lot with my friends and got to do things that kids nowadays never do.
Yeah. Are you in touch with any of those kids?
I am. Johnny Wink Miller and I have been friends since probably 8 years old, and we email each other every other week and have been doing that for years. And occasionally, we've seen each other and had a cup of coffee in Baltimore. Sometime this fall, I'm going to visit him in Delaware, where he has moved since he retired. He just turned 76.
Are you going to play red line
no,
or handball?
No, I don't think so, because neither one of us can run very well. What we'll do is we'll probably talk about our teenage romances. That seems to be
the big topic.
Big topic in our emails lately.
Glory days. As Bruce Springsteen says.
Oh. I have a question about your story.
Okay.
One of the things I wondered about is when did T.H. die?
1942.
Okay. I thought it was around the same time I was born, actually.
Yeah.
41.
I wish you had met him so you could tell me more stories about him. I wasn't alive then.
The question I have is there a recording of him at all?
No.
What a shame.
Yeah.
Because I've heard a lot, I've heard you tell a lot about his life, and that would be a precious thing to have.
Yes, it would be. Well, I hope that I get good enough with his voice in another 10 or 20 years.
You do a good job right now.
That you will have the experience of hearing the real
T.H. I think you do a
teenage.
Very good job right now. I do. I mean, if I wasn't looking at you, I would think.
I'm in and out of the voice, I think, but I'm working on it.
Right.
Well, thanks, Dash, for a wonderful story. I loved being back in the backyards of Baltimore, the back alleys of Baltimore with young Stosh.
Thank you.
I like Mr. Martinez and your dad talking about what to do about this kid with so much chutzpah.
Yeah.
And it does not matter what your explanation was. Right. That was beside the point. Yeah. They wanted you to understand you had trespassed and transgressed.
One of my father's guidelines for me was don't do something to mess up our family's name. Don't get in trouble with the police, and don't break the law. And I think a number of the parents, especially the fathers, were forgiving of the boys as long as we didn't do anything really bad. We never destroyed property or things like that. I do have a great story about Mr. Damison, the bar owner, but it would take too long to tell now. I got in a great deal of trouble because of him.
Okay. So. Well, we'll look forward to that story at another time. It's time to close out the show. John Case, can you tell us what's up next after we're finished with Stories in the Round?
Yes.
Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour.
We're going to be having a live United Kingdom Musical Fest, live concerts from a venue in Scotland that's going to go on for about 6 hours. So,
boy, so stay tuned.
Well, I have all these recordings, and so Mountain and Big Sky and a bunch of those groups, they're really one of the things that's cool about Scottish rock and roll is that it's all got great harmony. Mm. they like harmony in Scotland, apparently.
Okay. Well, we're going to get out of your way so that you can get that up.
Okay.
And I think I mentioned podcasts. We talked about stories in the round in Hagerstown. If people want more information about any storytelling series, you can contact me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638, or email me at fanitsky@hotmail.com. Thanks, Stosh.
You're very welcome, Fanny. This has been Stosh Zielkowski and
Fanny Crawford. Fanny Crawford,
co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, independent community radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The Epic Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Scottish music. Rock and roll.